Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 21st of August 2016. My name's Kirby Watson, and this week I'm joined by Paul in London, Caroline from Cannes Theatre Passion, Johnny Fox and Web Cowgirl. We're now going to talk about Allegro at the Southwark Playhouse. This is a musical by Richard Rodgers and Oscar Hammerstein, and it was their third or fourth collaboration after plays like Oklahoma and Carousel. It's been directed by the rather successful team of Tom Sutherland as director and Daniel Tarento as producer, and they're in their, possibly their favoured home, the Southwark Playhouse. Favoured, I hope, if the sound works properly. Paul, can you tell me more about this musical and what you thought of it?
Thanks, Tim. Yes, actually, it's quite interesting that this was their fourth collaboration, I think, if you take into account Oklahoma, Carousel, and State Fair. But that was originally a film before it then became a stage version. And I think what's different about this particular piece, and I think a lot of the press talks about how this was their forgotten piece, is that they did want to try something different, and they were actually really pushing what is a piece of musical theatre, because bearing in mind, the form was actually quite recent. So there was Showboat that Hammerstein collaborated on earlier on the piece, which really presented a play with music. And Oklahoma pushed that further and sort of made it quite groundbreaking as sort of integrating a book and music together. In this, they wanted to do something even a little bit further and actually explore. And it's more of about a single man's struggles with life. And actually, Allegro is really about an everyman. And I guess that's why he's probably called Joe, an average Joe, who just so happens to be the son of a country doctor and the compromises that he makes through his life. And the premise is to sort of track, I think they originally wanted to track him from birth to death, but I think they decided that would have been a very long show. So it goes from birth to midlife. Some have said birth to midlife crisis, but I'll leave others to determine whether how they felt the plot evolves in this. And it's interesting, actually, because by doing this, it's a different type of subject that Rodgers and Hammerstein tended to attack in their works. So South Pacific tackles racism. Some of their other shows tackle sexism and domestic violence. The Sound of Music tackled Nazis. Here, it's really very much about the individual. And in doing so, the music, actually, they've taken a very different approach to it. And there aren't particularly songs that you would necessarily think, you know, they're not 3-minute numbers. They're much more like motifs that actually appear throughout the piece and repeat as commentary on different stages of his life. And I think perhaps, probably for audiences 70 years ago when it was first made, this was actually probably a step too far in terms of the evolution of musical theatre. I think now we'd probably be a lot more comfortable with it. So what does this production actually offer? Well, actually, this one with producer Daniel Tarento and director Tom Sutherland have really given this piece quite a bit of a slick presentation and given it a lot of fast-paced movement. And I think they don't spend too much time on anything in this, and it gives it kind of a momentum of itself, which is interesting because the title Allegro refers to when the character Joe moves to the city and how there's just a fast-paced life, that there's no time to stop and think about anything, and people just create constant buzz and tension just so they can ignore real problems and real things in life. For me, I thought the production was wonderful. The sound works. I know the Southwark Playhouse has terrible acoustics, depending on which musical you see. But here, the work sounds terrific. The other thing I'd mention is that they use a lot of the Greek chorus in this piece. Sometimes they speak together, but often they actually sing. So the chorus is actually, they get the best songs in some respect, but also they're there throughout the piece commenting on the action. And I think it's quite fun to actually watch as they deploy this device. But I think, you know, the thing that struck me was how wonderful the whole ensemble sounded and performed together. The music was also particularly well done. And so I think it was a terrific production of this overlooked musical. I think it wasn't really as successful, probably because it actually is a bit too, it doesn't tackle a big meaty subject, and it was probably a little bit too innovative for its time. But I think 70 years on, it's nice to see this getting a full-scale professional debut in the Southwark Playhouse. I'll let others comment on the performances and other aspects of it, but, you know, I had a great time.
Caroline, what did you think?
I concur with what Paul actually said, to be honest. I loved it as a production. There were some key standout performances, although, as Paul said, for me, the ensemble was so strong, and it is really an ensemble piece. It could be, when you look at the synopsis, it could be kind of a dry scenario as a story. It's not tackling any big issues or anything like that. We're just literally having a whistle-stop tour of somebody's early life, basically. And it really, Allegro, you know, says it all. It's a rapid speed through somebody's life, and it's a transition between, you know, small town, small village to actual city life, and the pace is throughout. It's a pacey number as a show. So I enjoyed some key performances. Obviously, Gary Tushaw as Joe playing the pivotal part, and there were some other really nice formed characters as such throughout. So yeah, I enjoyed it immensely. The choreography was good and was really on point and very brisk as well, and quite innovative. The use of space as well was very innovative, although I did share concerns with other people that were there that night that, in actual fact, the climbing up of the staircases, you know, sometimes the brakes weren't always on, and there was a bit of a moment of a concern for the cast members involved. But yeah, terrific show, really terrific.
John?
I think the most important thing to say about this is that this production team can do no wrong. They have an ability to take any piece of work, however arcane, however long it has been since it hasn't been produced, and freshen it in a way that just makes it appealing. And I don't mean they're doing this in any formulaic way, because you couldn't say that this looks like Titanic or this looks like Grand Hotel. This is a delicious looking production. The lighting and costumes have given it a sort of sepia photographic tone that is magnificent, and the choreography, Lee Proud's work, is original, it's exciting, it makes patterns, it uses dance styles that aren't often incorporated into modern choreography. It's just very, very good. So the only fault is it's not a very well-written show. And the conceptual artists, you know, Rodgers and Hammerstein themselves didn't like it either. It had a short, well, it had a 9-month run on Broadway, and then it went on tour. And it was all right, but it didn't have the success of their other big productions. And I think one of the reasons for that is they had already fallen out slightly over Carousel, which Richard Rodgers wanted to be an opera, and Oscar Hammerstein wanted to be a more narrative piece and to stick more to the musical theatre form. They started writing Allegro in New York, and I think that Oscar Hammerstein had written the first act or something like that and given it to Dick Rodgers to produce the music, because that's the way they worked. Hammerstein wrote most of the story and the words, and Dick Rodgers only composed when he got the lyrics. And then Hammerstein went on a long sea voyage, I think to Australia, from where he sent the next batch or the last batch of the words to Rodgers. And during the sea voyage, I think he changed his mind about what he wanted this production to be. And he wanted it very much to be a narrative life story. And in his comment on it much, much later, Stephen Sondheim, who worked as a $25 a week runner on this show, said that he thought Oscar was trying to tell his own life story. Now, that gives it a very interesting perspective, but it doesn't make it a better show. Really, it lacks good, strong songs that you can take away. In fact, the only song that, and I did know The Gentleman is a Dope because several people, including Joe Stafford, recorded it. But the only other song I really, really knew quite well was Mountain Greenery. And the only reason I know that is because in an early Dick Van Dyke show, when they're asked to do a kind of party piece at some event they're both at, Mary Tyler Moore suggests to Dick Van Dyke they sing it, and they do. But I think that's Richard Rodgers' music and maybe Lawrence Hart's words, but the words don't appear in this production of Allegro, so it is still a Richard Rodgers piece of music. So I liked it. I enjoyed the evening. It's a wonderful production. But you begin to ask yourself two questions. One is, how many more musicals are there left to exhume? And how many of them are perhaps left buried? And then the other one is, I used this phrase when I was talking to Paul after the show, and he said, oh, you can't say that. But I almost wonder if there's a curse of Southwark Playhouse. Because, you know, half a mile up the road, you've got the Menier, with not much different in the way of resources and space, turning out musicals that constantly transfer into the West End. And then you have Southwark Playhouse doing equally good work, but they don't go anywhere. There just doesn't seem to be anywhere much for these pieces to go on to, except occasionally Trafalgar Studios or Charing Cross. It's not a big West End. Those are just stops on the Monopoly board. They're not big West End theatres. And I feel people must feel a bit frustrated, really, that they're doing wonderful, wonderful work, and yet this is where it starts and ends, and I think that's unfortunate as well. But nothing not to like in terms of the production or the performances. I didn't know a lot of the performers in this show. There aren't any names that I would have spotted big time from other shows that I might have seen there or in the West End. So again, Daniel Taranto, I think, has done most of the casting. You know, she's very resourceful at finding these excellent, excellent people. There's no weak link in the cast or the ensemble. It's a very strong ensemble piece. I quite like the Greek chorus effect. I thought it linked back to something that the production reminds me of. In the staging, it's a very lateral staging in, you know, traverse style with seating both sides of a long, narrow, flat floor level stage. And so in order to get some elevation and some excitement into it, they use a lot of ladders and gantries. And because of that, it reminded me very much of the staging of Our Town, the Thornton Wilder classic piece of small town America, where also characters speak directly to the audience, chorus style, in order to fill them in on bits of the plot or traits of the characters they're talking about. So I thought there are lots and lots of lovely, lovely meta-theatrical references here. And I think there's a great deal of wit in Tom Sutherland's production. But I don't think it's going to fly very far because of the basic fact that the raw material is not brilliant.
That's interesting, John, you mentioned about how many more musicals are there left to exhume, and also the fact about the curse of the Southwark Playhouse. In some way, I think they're interrelated. We seem to have a proponency in London to keep reviving musicals from 50, 60, 70 years ago, rather than looking at new works. Is that because the audiences in London really only want to go see familiar things? I'm not sure. But I think the other thing about the Southwark Playhouse is, unlike probably the Menier, which has a higher profile, so they can probably go to those bigger theatres in the West End. There's no way you can really send a musical into the West End, into a theatre really of this size, unless you're going to kick Stomp Out or something like that, don't you think?
I think it'd be a very good idea to kick Stomp Out. I also think the difference in formula is that the Menier does fewer productions and runs them for longer. So it has time to build up more momentum in a 3-month run of Funny Girl, let's say, than you get in 4.5 weeks of Allegro. And also, I do think that the Menier either happens to attract or pays for star names. And that possibly is a difference in why some of its things go a little bit further. But, you know, if you look at Carjo Foll, that went a very, very long way, not really because Douglas Hodge was such a big draw, but because it was a brilliant production of a musical that had been a little bit forgotten. So it could just be, you know, which ones do you get the rights to? So I've said this before and I'll say it again, do Pal Joey, because it's a wonderful show and it needs this kind of treatment and production.
We're now going to talk about The Collector, which is in the vaults underneath Waterloo Station, which has been transformed into a theatre. They do this quite a lot. In fact, this iteration of the vaults sees us having two theatres doing different work, depending on which dark corridor you pass down as you try to get into the theatre. The Collector is adapted by Mark Healy from a novel by John Fowles. In fact, it's John Fowles' first novel. John Fowles might be slightly better known for books like The French Lieutenant's Woman and The Magus. And actually, I did read The Collector recently, and it is a disturbing book. And for 1963, the content is somewhat prescient. The subject matter of this is something that is very much in the news these days, but is something I think was fairly new in 1963. And The Collector was also made into a film with Samantha Eggar and Terence Stamp, the main two roles. This adaptation is directed by Joe Houghton and stars Daniel Portman and Lily Lovelace. The original story, because they've actually updated it slightly, the original story is that Frederick Clegg wins a large amount of money on the pools. He leaves his job and buys a remote house in Sussex and does it up so that he can invite a guest into the cellar. He tends to think of it like this. He doesn't really understand what he's doing wrong, but he has become obsessed by a young woman called Miranda Gray, who is an art student, and he's seen her once or twice on the street and has basically fallen in love with her and thinks that if he can be in her presence for long enough that she will fall in love with him as well. He is, well, naive and rather innocent in many ways, and in fact that's one of the things that makes this not quite as a horrific evening as you might expect, because, you know, we all know about these kind of abductions and we all know how terrible they really are. And this has almost an air of innocence about it, which is rather surprising. This is a two-hander. Basically, the kidnap has taken place. Miranda Gray wakes up having been chloroformed and has to comply with what he says. I think you can stand the idea of this because Frederick Clegg is so innocent and rather dim, and he doesn't really want to hurt her. He just wants her to love him. Although he can obviously physically control her and keep her locked up, he never really is violent, and he's certainly not sexual. In fact, he's very much not sexual. When she tries to use it as a weapon on him, he doesn't know how to cope. And it becomes clear that she is completely wrong for him in so many ways, and he can't quite understand her at all, and as well as not really understanding what it is he's done wrong. This production has a slight problem for me, which was that they have updated it to, well, we're not entirely sure that it's modern times, but it's been partially updated. One of the reviewers I read said, and I probably agree with them, that what's happened here is that this is a very fringe production, so that they basically can't set it in 1963 because they can't afford all the period props and costumes. So they very much have lots of modern stuff, but it's also slightly out of date. I mean, you have things like CDs, and you talk about the National Lottery, so it feels as if it was set 20 years ago rather than being set right now. And although there's the National Lottery and there's CDs, there's no computers, there's no mobile phones, so, you know, you can think of more like 20 years ago than right now. But that jars slightly, because although there are these occasional mentions, there's a whole lot of other bits and pieces, certainly in terms of the class attitudes and the sexual attitudes, and also the idea of somebody going shopping in London and having difficulties with parking, which are very sort of contemporary to the 1960s. I mean, you literally can't go shopping in London without going by public transport unless you're a maniac. But there is this difficulty in the play that they've clearly updated bits of it, but not all of it, so it doesn't quite mesh together that well. That said, I think it is well performed by the two actors. Daniel Portman, obviously somebody I've been looking forward to seeing since I've seen him in Game of Thrones, and I do tend to collect them, but he is a very interesting actor, and he is completely different. But he's very good in this, I thought. Lily Lovelace, who I don't know quite so well, although she's been in lots of television things, this is actually her professional stage debut. I thought they did it very well, but in the end I think this play doesn't quite work because there are certain things about the attitudes not quite meshing with the slightly modernised setting that they've got, and also that we are very aware of the horrors of people being kept in cellars, and it's not something that can be treated lightly or innocently in the way this is. And there's certainly something like Miranda Gray. Her reaction to this is very self-centered, and it kind of works in the book that she's a lot more concerned about her own life and her past, and she's not sort of screaming about being set free. I mean, there's one of the parts of this almost naive thing that Frederick Clegg does is that he says he's going to set her free after a certain time. And it almost looks as if that's going to happen. I mean, other things happen to stop that happening, and that's why we get an interesting ending to the play, and it only needs to be a two-hander. But she's not reacting with the horror that we kind of expect there to be. Paul, what did you think about this?
You know, Tim, you just hit, I think, the nail on the head here, actually, with this piece. Well, and while you were talking, I just realized that's the thing that I actually had difficulty getting in this whole piece, was that actually, if it's not set in the 1960s, then it's very difficult to believe the reactions of the female characters, Miranda, simply because there's been too much in the years since this was first written as a book, you know, apart from Psycho, 30 years of slasher films and horror films, some pretty gruesome real life kidnappings and serial murders that have happened. I'm thinking Ted Bundy and the likes like that, men who preyed upon women for various reasons, and that sort of thing. I think that, for me, makes it very difficult to accept Miranda's initial reactions if it's not set in the 60s. And I think it wasn't clear in the staging, was it present day or was it some time ago? Because actually, if it was present day, or at least in the last 20 years, I would have expected Miranda's reactions to be completely different. Because actually, it probably makes more sense if it's from the freewheeling 60s, when people were like, oh yeah, he's just kidnapped me with chloroform. Yeah, that's okay. I'm just going to go with the vibe. But now that would certainly not be the case. I think for me, though, the performances were terrific. That was the highlight of the whole piece. Both performers, you know, there was an excellent rapport between the two as captor and captee. But also, I think they kept the intensity and the focus of the drama really tight. And I think Daniel Portman, you know, he's likable enough, particularly from his other roles. And I think you do see an actor in a particular way, particularly if you've seen him in other work. So he comes in as this likable man and playing this, what becomes a very unpleasant character, I think. But just solely on his performance, I think, makes him likable and makes you kind of feel a bit sorry for him. I must say, though, I didn't stay for the full length of the piece, and that wasn't due to the performances. It was more to do with the venue. But I think I may not have had that same view had I stayed through the whole piece. But I thought the performances were terrific from what I saw. I have to say, though, venues are really important. And I think in the summer months in London, having a venue that isn't properly air conditioned, I don't think is acceptable in this stage, even if it is a fringe venue. I think there are other problems with the venue. The Vaults seems to think it's acceptable to make the audience walk down a long dark corridor into a bar and drink from what looks like dirty glassware. You know, it might be charming for some people, but actually I think there's a basic standard of cleanliness that needs to be accepted in most theatres, even if they are fringe or pop-up venues. Fringe doesn't mean dirty. And I think there were some technical problems the night I saw it as well. It sounded like I was getting through the speakers what sounded like somebody's Snapchat messages. And so that was slightly disorienting and distracting from the performances. And I'm not sure what was the problem there. But I think ultimately it was too hot that evening. I'm sure other people that stayed through it probably enjoyed the piece immensely and its very creepy message. But I think I'll go back to the point that the update doesn't actually make a great deal of sense. And that's not a fault of anything. Performances, that's really, I think, decisions that they made at the beginning of how and when this would be set.
We're now going to talk about the play on the Stars at the National Theatre. This is a production of Sean O'Casey's 1926 play, which is about the Easter Rising and a couple who are caught up in it, and in fact a lot of ordinary Dubliners who are caught up in the Easter Rising. Most of them are on the side of the Irish Citizen Army and the Volunteers, the people who are rebelling against British rule. But we also have one or two characters who are staunchly loyalist, and indeed even a couple of British soldiers. We start in the tenement flat apartment of Jack Clitheroe and his wife Nora. They are young and passionate, or very loving, and Nora is terrified that Jack might choose to rejoin the Irish Citizen Army. Before the First World War broke out, there were an awful lot of people shipping guns into various parts of Ireland because it was almost on the verge of a civil war because of a Home Rule Bill. So there was a lot of tension, a lot of militias cropping up and a lot of arms being brought in. People like Sir Roger Casement smuggled arms from Germany in, and one or two others, I think Erskine Childers, the writer of Riddle of the Sands, also brought in a large amount of German weaponry in for the Irish Republicans. There were also a lot of Unionists shipping in weapons from various different places, and if the First World War hadn't broken out, it would be very likely that there would have been a civil war in Ireland in the next few years. There were a lot of tensions, and this is really what built into the rebellion 100 years ago at Easter in Dublin, where a group of people took over things like the post office and various other government buildings and held out for, I think it's about just over a week, I think it's about 11 days. So this is really the dawning of the Irish Republic. It is the act that comes to form the Irish Republic. Things settle down for a while, but after the war, there is a landslide election victory for Republicans, and basically then a fight between the British and the Irish to gain control of Ireland, and then after there is a treaty, there is then another civil war where the different people involved in it, the people who agreed with the treaty and the people who didn't agree with the treaty, then fought each other to a standstill. And you ended up with an odd thing like Éamon de Valera, who was anti-treaty on the losing side, but eventually became president of Ireland for many years. So he was, the pro-treaty people won, which meant that Ireland was theoretically at peace, but the anti-treaty people sort of took over anyway in the end. A bit of background, if you don't know your Irish history, it's fascinating stuff. And what O'Casey does here is he looks at the rebellion from the point of view of a very ordinary people. Most of these people are various kinds of pro-independence, pro-a republic, and we get an opening scene in the tenement. Various characters come in and out, visiting Nora and her husband, getting him to re-volunteer for the fighting force. And Nora is extremely upset about this, and it's almost crazed in some ways how much she's upset by the idea that Jack is going to go back and fight. There's quite a lot of comedy. In this production, as with the Silver Tassie at the National Theatre a few years ago, we've actually got a kind of comedic double act. There's characters called Peter Flynn and Flutha Good. They're played by Lloyd Hutchinson and Stephen Kennedy, respectively. And their characters were used, they're kind of a bit of a comic relief throughout it, and they're almost like a chorus commenting on the action as it's going through. They're in practically every scene. They're not brave. They're too old to be involved in the uprising, but they're sort of on side. And in fact, the Peter Flynn character has had some involvement with, I think, an Irish volunteer brigade in Mexico or something. I'm not entirely sure of that part of the history. I'll have to look it up. But this couple, and these two actors indeed, much as they acted in the Silver Tassie, they kind of act as commenters on the action and also as a comedic relief to what would otherwise be a dark tale. The second scene is set in a public house, and we have a meeting going on outside. We're probably looking at James Connolly. We can't really hear the speech that he's making. James Connolly is one of the leaders of the Easter Rising. He's making a speech. We hear fragments of it, but not all of it, and people cheer, and then people come in and out of the pub, and you get various colourful characters. One of the colourful characters in this is Bessie Burgess, who is a street vendor, and unlike most of her neighbours, she lives in the same tenement, but unlike most of her neighbours, she is Protestant, and she is pretty much Unionist. I think she has a son who is fighting the war, because we were in the middle of the First World War during the Easter Rising. She's always annoying everybody, and always speaking out against everybody. She appears to be a rather toxic individual. But in the next few scenes, the next scene we're on a street corner outside the tenement and there's looting, the uprising has failed, people are retreating. Jack is trying to help a wounded comrade to some kind of medical attention, but his wife, who has been ranging the streets demanding to see him, is trying to pull him back into the tenement. And in the end, he runs off from her. She goes into a state. She is pregnant. They are expecting a child, and there's a worry that she might lose it. And then in the last one, what is left of the cast is cramped in this upper floor of a building. There is martial law. There are British troops on the streets, and they are looking for rebels. Peter Flynn has been killed. And Nora has, as a result of that and losing her baby, although she doesn't know that she's lost her baby, she is heartbroken. But the person who is giving the most care to her, as unlikely as it seems, is this character of Bessie Burgess, who is one of these people who yells at you but helps you out anyway, who's, you know, obnoxious but extremely good-hearted. The good-heartedness never does her any good. And in fact, it doesn't. And there are tragic consequences for, well, pretty much everybody in this. I saw this play back in 1991. You've got names like Neve Cusack and Dervla Molloy and John Rogan, Stanley Townsend, and also Judi Dench, who played Bessie Burgess. It was a bit of a starry role. She was, at the time, oddly enough, not the national treasure that she became a few years later. This is 1991. She becomes a national treasure in about 94 or 95 after Mrs. Brown and after she becomes M. At the time, she was merely the leading stage actress in the country, which she had been for about 20 years. Rather an interesting production, that. But I think I enjoyed this one more. This lives in my memory better. And in this production, Bessie Burgess is played by Justine Mitchell. She gives a very nice performance, I think, and it brings across that she's nasty but with a heart of gold, and I thought it worked particularly well, although it has to be said she does take a long time to die, which is perhaps annoying for quite a lot of people. The thing I found most annoying about this production was how little I like Nora Clitheroe, the wife who's demanding her husband to stay with her. I think I'm supposed to sympathise with her. I think the play is about finding some sympathy with her, and I felt very guilty for not finding any sympathy in this production.
I kind of wanted her to be shot myself. It was a real disappointment. When you see a play with so much death and dying going on, for it not to land upon the one person you would most like to not hear talking for the rest of the play.
Overall, it's a good piece, and it was an interesting companion piece to The Silver Tassie. What did you think about this, Whipcow Girl?
This play joins what I wouldn't call sort of a pantheon, but a select group of plays that I have seen in the Littleton that have basically given me the equivalent of theatrical post-traumatic stress disorder. I'm afraid at times to walk into the Littleton for fear that I'm going to be trapped in a truly miserable, overly long show with a bunch of characters that I pretty uniformly detest. And The Plow and the Stars was absolutely one of those plays. I think the things it was most particularly successful at was creating a vibrant, well, recreation of what it might be like to live in a slum in Ireland in the 1920s. This was also done in Juno and the Paycock by the same author, Sean O'Casey, which I also found just completely intolerable. I was grateful for the moments of humor, but I found them also completely irritating because the play was already too long. My summary of this play would be quite a bit quicker. It is really, I think, difficult to plunge into this with zero knowledge of Irish history. To, I will hope, my credit, I am coming at this as a complete foreigner born in another part of the world, and I have been struggling just to get caught up with English history, as well as attempting to learn Scottish and Welsh history, and indeed how it is that Ireland came to be split in two, because those weren't things that I learned about growing up. The one thing that was really on my mind during the course of this play was that this play was set during World War I. And when all of these commemorations of the various centenaries of the war have been going on, such as the revival of the Silver Tassie that took place quite recently. The events of that war are quite firmly in my mind, and to see a play set amongst civilians in a part of the world that was supposed to be on I knew what side of the battle against the Austro-Hungarian Empire, to see those people getting ready to shoot the same soldiers that were supposed to keep us from being overrun by the other side of the war made me feel cold in my stomach, because this wasn't just going to be a civil war. This was going to be something that was going to detract from Great Britain's ability to succeed in World War I. And I know how power responds when there's an internal threat at a moment when there's a huge external threat. Because what you do is you go in there and you blow it out of the water, and then you burn what's left behind, and you make sure that there is nothing. And to watch the people in Act One being all excited and wearing their fancy parade uniforms, and then in Act Two getting all excited about going to fight against the same side that they were supposed to be working with in order to win the bigger war, was chilling. And I didn't see how anybody could possibly be aware of the fact that there was a big war going on, and that the country that they were going to be fighting against was not going to come in and completely destroy them. And it made me feel like I was watching a bunch of people who were not able to make any sort of rational decision about how safe they were going to be, what the possibility of success was going to be. And then when the whole thing, as it is shown in this play in Act Three, essentially descends into looting by the poor and door-to-door murders, I found myself very, very much not enjoying the play. And I can't get behind the foolishness in the first two acts. I couldn't laugh at the laughter. I was revolted by the thuggery of the third act. And I found the way that the people didn't work together also really kind of heartbreaking, although I think it was extremely realistic in its own way of showing like what people's concerns were. And Nora was indeed irritating, whiny woman, but in some ways I felt that that character was the only one who really clearly understood what the impact of this fight was going to be on her life, which was that it was going to destroy it. And the mad scene that O'Casey wrote for her was, I thought, quite convincing, and up there with, I think, you know, not to diss the bard, but it was up there with Lady Macbeth and with Lucia de Lammermoor, some of the best depictions of being crazy and the right kind of trigger that I've ever seen on stage. She was, you know, a detestable, whiny character, extraordinarily selfish, and completely and utterly unconcerned, you know, about things like pride, but she at least understood what the consequences of war was and what the consequences of war are on a civilian population. And all the people who were, you know, waving their feathered hats and cheering, I think, had very little idea of how much death they were going to have to face. It made me think that the people of Ireland must have had centuries of having a damn raw deal in order to be so ready to just go ahead and die in the hopes of changing how their colonial oppressors were treating them. I would like to add, though, that the death scene of Bessie Burgess, who was also a completely hateful and obnoxious character, was, I think, extremely well done. One of the problems with people dying on stage is it actually takes longer for people to die than most people are willing to give stage time. I mean, usually if somebody dies, you know, if they have like a heart attack or a stroke, you know, you can be talking days or weeks, but it's boring to do it that way. But for somebody to bleed out 8, 10, 20 minutes is actually, you know, just right. And I thought OKC must have seen people dying in order to give Bessie Burgess the amount of time that she needed to walk us through the experience. And I thought that overall, the message that I got from this play was how completely terrible war will always be to the people who live in the war zone. And watching this, watching these people die, watching these soldiers brutalize the population, watching things fall apart, it made me think of what's going on right now in Syria. And that actually gave this play, in my eyes, the opportunity to be more than just a specific play about a specific time and some specific historical events. OKC did actually, I think, perhaps accidentally get to a point of universality where he was showing in Act Three the situations and the pain and the suffering that apply to, I think, every civilian population in a war zone. And for all that I completely loathe this play and I could have lived without Act One and probably most of Act Two and most of the characters and most of the joke scenes, that Act Three was a tremendous payout. And for those who are interested in World War One or in Irish history, or would just like a chance to see some actresses really pulling the stops out, then you might find Plow and Stars worthwhile investment of your time and money. However, overall, I found it too painful, too long, and too slow. And I have now seen three plays by Sean O'KC, and I can say that I will never see another because I have seen enough. It's not a style that I care for, and I think the plays are too long. So I wouldn't quite ask for my time and money back based on Act Three, but I have now been completely put off this playwright and won't go see anything by him anymore.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the Azeta named London Theatre Podcast page on Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com, and the podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you, goodbye.